It's in the title as one of the important things that we're utilizing. And I want to explain exactly what that is, which is a way to sort of scan square root of S in a way to be independent of the mass of the signal that we're producing. So we require events to have at least one photon with 10 GeV of energy from initial state radiation. And the reason that this is useful is that that ISR photon can have any energy ranging from zero up until that center of mass energy. And when we collide E plus E minus, a key difference with respect to proton-proton collisions is that we know exactly the initial center of mass energy in that collision. And so however much energy that photon takes away is the energy that's available to us in the collision. And that can be used to sort of scan when you have some resonant sort of cross-section, you can scan the masses of that new particle sort of, and this becomes the analogy of what we of how we do a typical diget invariant mass bump hunt at the LHC. So the plot on this slide here is showing that shape of the center of mass energy for our typical Drellian background. And then when you have some resonances, either a 700 GeVx or a different mass point x, say 350 GeV, you get these resonance spikes in square root of S. And you can imagine how much energy an ISR photon would have to take away in order to put us right at that resonance center of mass energy. And so we're really looking at the distribution of photon energies, and that allows us to look at the distribution of new X masses. So now to get into the actual training setup, we model our inputs using particle flow networks, which describe an event as an unordered variable length set of jets. We use a lot of information here, up to 15 jets per event, and then 10 features per jet. And so that gives us something like 150 input features for events. So this really is a fairly high dimensional training scenario. And then there are two other critical elements of the training that will come into play with the results. We normalize all the jets to the average PT, eta, and phi in the event. This is to avoid any type of correlation with square root of S that may bias our results. And then we noticed quite a bit of variance in the training when we first started this. And so we do an ensembling procedure where we train 50 models per setup, each with a random signal injection. We then quantile scale the outputs of all 50 of those models and average them. And that makes everything a little bit more stable as we started to try to repeat these results in different setups. So I'll start with the semi-supervised training configuration. This was sort of the benchmark. This is a little bit more vanilla, typical signal versus background classifier. What we might consider as it applies to the an analysis is a data versus simulation training. And so what we do here is just select a narrow signal region defined as a window of center of mass energy right around that resonance mass of 700 GeV. And then we just train two different classes. One of them, what we label zeros, is all background all of the time. And then on the other side, what we label as ones can range from all background to all signal. So we start to add in more and more signal, essentially to get a sense of how many signal events need to be present in order for this classifier to be able to distinguish them. So we train with a variety of different signal contaminations in one of those classes. And then the way that we assess the performance of this is through the significance improvement characteristics. So not quite a rock, it's got TPR, regular signal efficiency on the x-axis, but instead on the y-axis, we have the signal sensitivity. So something like a proxy for S over square root B. And so this number on the y-axis would tell us the extent to which we can enrich a particular amount of signal excess after utilizing the output score of this net. And we see a pretty remarkable improvement here for that 700 GeV signal. For something down to maybe 0.5% of signal contamination in one of those labeled classes, we can enrich this by almost a factor of 10. There would be some point on this curve. So this was really exciting to see as even just as the benchmark, that there is a lot of power here to discriminate even really small amounts of signal after this high dimensional PFN type setup. But this wasn't actually the spirit of what we're trying to do here. We wanted to not have any signal labeling at all, and we want to move to a fully data-driven training setup. And so that brings me to the discussion of the method that we use to do that fully data-driven training, which is the weakly supervised method that we implement via the Koala method in general. And so the primary idea of the Koala method is that we don't just train something with labeled signal and labeled background. We instead train with labeled signal region versus labeled sideband. And in something like the typical diget invariant mass hunt that you can see in this cartoon here, the signal region will have a sort of an enrichment of the signal, but there will be a little bit of signal due to the tails of that mass peak in each one of your sidebands. And that means that you have two different regions that have different admixtures of signal to background. And a classifier that takes those labels as input will end up learning the actual differences between signal and background events, because there's nothing else for it to learn to distinguish these two. And so in the case of the original implementation of Koala was with MJJ, where the signal region and the sideband were defined in windows of MJJ, where you'd have a sideband on either side of your expected signal resonance. And then the input features that this classifier was trained over were just the two diget masses. So in our case, things are a little bit more complicated. Oh, wait. Bring your shared window to the front. Can you see again?
Yeah, yes. We can still see them.
Okay, cool. I tried to click the slide and somehow I slid myself to a different desktop. Right, so I was talking about the difference from the typical, the diget MJJ version of the qual analysis to the one that we're implementing in E plus E minus, which is that we now define our signal region and sideband in bins of square root of S. And then the input features that we are training over are up to 150 per event. So the classification task itself has become quite a bit more complicated, but the core of the method is still really nicely applicable to this radiative return center of mass collision scenario in E plus E minus. And so I mentioned, I think something that I said on the previous slide is that when you have this different admixture of signals, background events, your classifier ends up learning the differences between signal and background because there's nothing else for it to learn. That statement is actually depends on the fact that there is no correlation with square root of S with respect to what is learned by the classifier. So since your signal region, your sideband, the two different regions that you're training are defined in different bins of square root of S, there's a possibility that if all of your input information was strongly correlated, that your classifier would learn how to distinguish those two regions just based on their square root of S value. And so I mentioned the normalization procedure is what we've implemented to make sure that this is not a strong effect in our results. And the way that we can verify that it is not a strong effect is by training background and signal region versus background and sideband. So those events themselves should be very, very similar. They only vary in square root of S value. And so this classifier trained over background only in these different regions should be able to learn nothing if we don't have strong square root of S correlations. And that's exactly what you see in the rock on page 12 here, that our ability to distinguish background from background in different bins of square root of S is basically nothing. This is really just a random guess here. And that sort of validates our ability to take this exact classifier and use it to actually separate signal with this signal region versus sideband training. And so that brings me to the good stuff, the actual anomaly detection weekly supervised results. So we keep the exact same signal region as we had in the semi-supervised case, and then we define our sidebands as 50 GeV windows around that signal region. And we look at the performance with the exact same metric, this significance improvement characteristic for the same signal, the same set of the neural net, and then the same different signal contaminations that we have in one of those labeled classifiers. And one of the nice things that we notice is that there's not such a significant degradation in performance after we really remove the signal hypothesis. So that point, that signal contamination that I pointed out before, which was this one sigma excess, now we get up to maybe a factor of three enhancement of that one sigma excess. So we nicely put ourselves over the evidence for this particular signal. It's certainly not a factor of 10, but in fact, if you really compare these two side by side and you look at the other different signal contaminations, there's even less degradation in the higher signal contaminations. And this is actually a feature of the koala method, that if that classifier that is optimal separating signal region from sideband, it will actually be optimal for also separating signal from background. So this gives us a good sense that we're well modeling our inputs. The training setup is working for us well. And it's really exciting to see that we would have, in a weekly supervised context, pretty nice enrichment after applying this method on some new type of signal, some new resonant hadronically decaying signal, I should say. And so I mentioned that there is an element of this that pertains to actual experimental design. And so this is something that we did want to consider in the course of this paper. As I'm talking about this measuring of the photon mass and these ISR photon events, the detector features, things like mass resolution or the forward acceptance of those initial state radiation photons would be really important for what we're able to do with this analysis. So we can imagine different ways of measuring that center of mass energy. For example, if you capture the photon, you actually measure its energy with a detector, or if it is lost, it is, you know, outside of acceptance somehow, and you have to measure the center of mass energy just by summing up all of the final state hadrons. And so you can see here that whether or not you capture the photon has a really big impact on how narrow these resonances are. We get quite a bit more smearing if we have to rely on the hadrons themselves. And so this is one of the things that we wanted to understand and maybe even inform detector design, how forward these detectors should go, what kind of resolution we can expect we would like to have with the calorimeters for maximal new physics sensitivity in the anomaly detection context. So this brings me to our conclusions. This is a really nice and successful application of anomaly detection to this brand new E plus E minus collision data set. It was really, I think, fun for us to kind of learn about what those data sets might look like and start to get ourselves out of the proton-proton collision mindset. I think this also is a really nice way to look at these high-dimensional particle flow network inputs. This is also something that I hadn't personally worked with so much, but it seemed to be really, really beneficial, even in just the data versus simulation classification, all anomaly detection discussion aside. But then, of course, when we do bring it to the data-driven training scenario, there's really not so much degradation in what we're able to achieve. And I guess really the important thing here is that we are able to enhance sensitivity to some generic new physics signature without a particular signal prior. This signal was, some resonant thing that decayed to heavy flavor physics, but of course we'd be really eager to see how this works with different types of new physics. And as I mentioned, we now officially have an archive link. So there are even more studies in the archive link that I didn't have time to go into here. We compare the actual performance of the method in those different measures of square root of S that I showed on the previous slide. We look at a different X resonance mass of 350 GeV. And then for fun, we even looked at semi plus or minus event level variables to see just how kind of compare that particle flow network to the typical way that you could imagine doing this at some LEP type experiment and understand what our options are there as well. So thanks very much for the attention. I'm happy to take any questions or discussion.
Thank you very much, Julia. I think it's a really nice talk and very interesting results. And congratulations on getting your archive paper out today. Good timing. Questions for Julia or comments? I guess maybe while people are thinking of questions, could you perhaps expand on if you have further plans on this related to, you know, making it part of the snow mass? I mean, of course, this is already pretty good and can go in. But are you thinking, for example, of also looking beyond E plus E minus, or is that what you're mainly concentrating on, or other, plans for the next upcoming year?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely want to carry this on in some way. I mean, this was prepared for, I guess, kind of prepared for Snowmass 2021, but since we have the extra time, we might as well keep thinking about it. We have not discussed other types of collisions. I think more the discussion as it comes to the experiment itself would be maybe different types of new physics that this could be sensitive to. What would be the analyses that we'd really want to be focusing on as it comes to E plus E minus? We've also talked a little bit with the future accelerators folks, and maybe if we had, you know, a 10 TeV or a 20 TeV E plus E minus machine, how does this conclusion change? What might be the physics motivations for some even higher energy E plus E minus? And I'm also, I think, interested as it comes to E plus E minus in developing really good simulations. I think that there's a possibility in E plus E minus that we can actually do a data versus simulation training, and that might be sufficient for a method like this. So I think those are all kind of relevant questions that one might ask after this paper that I think we're going to be looking into and hopefully have some other new results ready by the actual Snowmass next year.
Right. And, you know, thinking about it, and of course, you know, you're probably applying it to, for example, Atlas data or thinking of, but again, there are other kinds of these sort of low mass resonances in some cases, you know, at which point you're also run into booster topologies. And then having more information via this kind of a method to also look into those kind of signatures, which are already quite challenging, but maybe this gives an added edge or benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing we always think of at the LHC, right? Is like all of these methods come up on some kind of jet substructure, and so it's interesting to think, you know, when it comes to the different pile up and substructure type distributions, we might get at E plus E minus. I think that's, yeah, I agree. Definitely a core question of moving this to different applications.
Right, and especially because I think that, you know, both looking at full simulation and then I think there's very little that's been done for boosted topologies for sort of snow mass-like future efforts yet. I mean, there's been extensive work done at the LHC, but not so much for snow mass yet. So that was one of our initial goals, was to sort of look in that area, for that you again need full simulation, I think, or as good a simulation as we can get.
Right.
It's difficult to do it with Delphi's and other things. But no, this is very promising. So thanks again. And let's see, any other questions or comments? Right, looks like not. So thank you again, Julia.
Great, thanks.
And we can move on to the next talk. So Rob Harris is going to tell us about sensitivity to digit resonances at PP colliders. If you could unshare, Julia.
I've lost the window. Ah, here it is. Okay. Stop share. Sorry about that. Thanks.
No problem.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, Rob, we can hear you. I don't know if you want to go to full screen. This is fine too. We can see it quite well.
Is
Up
it
to you.
on full? Am I showing the? I can't see what I'm showing is a problem.
It's okay. I mean, we can see it pretty well. It's sort of in the browser still, but it's okay if you
I
can.
see. Okay, very good. All righty. So I'm Robert Harris, a scientist at Fermilab, and I will tell you about the status of the sensitivity search for dye jet resonances at proton-proton colliders. So this is, as an introduction, this is a benchmark channel for discovery at PP colliders. I'll tell you about the QC background and the dye jet resonance signal, and I'll estimate the sensitivities for 5 sigma discovery and 95% confidence level exclusion, and I'll conclude. So this is an essential benchmark of discovery for the capability of proton-proton colliders. The discovery process is sensitive to a variety of new physics at the highest mass scales. It's predicted by countless models proposed to address fundamental questions. And proton-proton colliders are natural dye jet resonance factories. The dye jet resonances are produced by annihilation of partons and the colliding protons, and they must decay to 2 partons, giving dye jets. So we estimate the sensitivity of PP
Rob,
colliders.
Sorry, I think you're still stuck on the first slide.
Oh my.
Yeah, I think you're sharing the window and not the screen. So if you go in full screen, it will not show that when you advance. So you need to either share the full screen and then you can go full. Can go for screen presentation mode, or otherwise
so,
you need to stay with the window.
Can you see the slide 3 now?
Correct.
Yeah, can you try to go to 4? Let's see if you can go to 4.
Can you see 4 now?
Yeah, we can. Okay, this is good.
I'm sorry about that.
No problem,
okay.
Please.
So as I said, this is an essential benchmark, and proton-proton colliders are natural dye jet resonance factories. And here we're going to estimate the sensitivity of PP colliders to this essential process. So PP colliders, this is a comprehensive study of all scenarios for current and future PP colliders. We're going to consider 8 collision energies, the LHC, the HLLHC, the HELHC. For the FCCHH, 100 is the standard energy, 100 GeV, but we'll also consider 75, 150, 200, all energies that were mentioned during snowmass. And also the why not the collider in the sea at 500 GeV. We're going to consider 10 integrated luminosities, 5 general values with logarithmic spacing between 10 and 10 to the fifth inverse femtobarns, and 5 benchmark integrated luminosities previously used or recommended. The 140 inverse femtobarns for run 2, 200 inverse femtobarns for run 3, HLHC at 3 inverse attobarns, FCCHH at 2.5 was used in our study, and 30 inverse attobarns, which is the standard. And we'll estimate the mass sensitivity for discovery and exclusion of dye jet resonances at all the root S's and integrated luminosities. The methodology is we're going to use lowest order parton level calculations of the QC background and signals. This is an update to my study for snowmass 1995. Seems like yesterday, but we'll supplement it with more modern simulation estimates of the signal acceptance in the mass window. We'll use selection cuts similar to publications from the LHC, both final state partons in the central region, a less than 2.5. We'll put a cut on delta eta, which is like a cosine theta star cut, to suppress the QCT channel pole. And we'll calculate the signal and background inside a search window. It's centered on a pole mass of the resonance and has a 16% width. The signal acceptance of this cut is estimated from CMS resonance shapes. I'll discuss that more later. And then we're just gonna estimate the number of events and the cross section in the background the single model masses that are required for 95% confidence level exclusion and 5 sigma discovery. So here is the lowest order QC calculation of the background to LHC data as a function of digest mass. So that's the red. This is the leading order QCD calculation using this renormalization scale and this PDF. And here is the CMS data from run two. And it agrees within 10% of the CMS data from run two. Now, CMS uses wide jets, a cone of a delta R of 1.1. And that's one of the reasons why it matches so well. Just a leading order 2-to-2 calculation. And so we're going to use these same choices for all PP collision energies. We're going to use the same renormalization scale. We're going to use the same CTEC PDFs as they reproduce well the CMS data. So here then are the QCD backgrounds to digest resonances in the mass window for all colliders, from the LHC in blue, HELHC in green, FCCHH options in red, and collider in C in magenta. And if you take a look at a mass, let's say a proportional to the collision energy at like 40% of the collision energy, you can see the cross-section gradually decreasing as a function of resonance mass. And we'll be investigating the high mass searches, and they use QCD data that's generally between about 5% of the collision energy and about 75% of the collision energy. And so we show that here for all of the colliders. And so this is the background in the mass window. Then we consider the signal. So we have now resonance models, multiple benchmark models we're going to consider, spanning a range of cross sections from various interaction strengths. The main model that we're going to look at right now, for which we have preliminary results now, is excited quarks, which you have a quark gluon initial and final state. This is the earliest benchmark for searches at Hadron colliders, conducted at SPP bar S and at the Tevatron and LHC. These are the first searches were done for this model. It has a large cross-section because it's strongly produced. And other models we'll explore fully later, and we have a few preliminary results for now, are listed here. There are scalar diquarks, which are QQ states. They have a large cross-section because they're produced from the valence quarks of the proton. And so they have very large PDFs, and so they have large cross-sections. There'll be colorons, which are again strongly produced because they're massive gluons. More weakly produced objects are, for example, the W prime and Z prime, in which we'll have electroweak-like production of these sequential standard model bosons. And then Wrangel-sum and gravitons are also relatively weakly produced from this warped extra dimension model. And again, we're going to do lowest order calculations of the total signal cross-section using the same PDF and a renormalization scale equal to the mass inside the mass window. And we're going to include our cuts for the angular cuts, and we'll get those at lowest order. And then we're going to multiply that by a signal acceptance in the digest mass window to get the total cross section. So on the signal acceptance, for the resonance shape that's observed actually in the experiments, they typically have a Gaussian core from experimental resolution. And then they have a long, low tail from radiation, final state radiation, and from the parton distributions at low X, amplifying the bright vigor tail at low digest mass. Now, we're going to use an observation of acceptance scaling, where the window acceptance should be roughly independent of the center of mass energy of the collider at a fixed fraction of the collider's energy. And we're going to check that acceptance scaling with Monte Carlo simulations of signals at each collision energy, which you'll see on the next slide. So here's our observation of the scaling of the resonance shape. So here we have, for example, the Q-star shape for gen jets with resonance mass at a fixed fraction of root S, 50% of the root S of the machine, shown in blue for the LHC, shown in red for FCCHH, and shown in black for root S of 500 TeV, the collider in the C. And you can see that for Y gen jets, the shapes are very, very similar. And the acceptances are also going to be very, very similar at this fixed fraction of the collision energy. And that's the property we observe of acceptance scaling. It works better for the Y-gen jets than it does for the AK-4 jets, where the effect of final state radiation is more acute because you lose energy from the jet cone, and then you depend more on the actual root S of the collider involved. So we're now gonna go ahead and do our first estimates. The expected cross-section upper limits, which are shown in dashed for the LHC, are compared to the signal models in mass windows. And here we have all the signal models, not just excited quarks. And that will, where the lines cross, gives the snow mass expected mass limits on models. And these limits over here in red agree pretty well with the CMS public limits and the ATLAS public limits. And here are the mass window acceptances that occur at the limit values. So this is a check that the estimated sensitivity from mean calculations of events in a window works well enough. So we go on to five sigma discovery projections. Here's preliminary plots for FCC-HH on the left and HELHC at 27 TV on the right. The discovery cross-section is once again the dashed black line shown for all 10, shown for the luminosities that pertain to the machine. Actually, here on the right is just the five benchmark ones, and here are eight benchmark ones that might pertain to that machine over here are shown here. The discovery cross-section is inversely proportional to the square root of the integrated luminosity, of course, where there are large backgrounds and these lines are closely spaced. It's inversely proportional to just the luminosity, of course, where there is no background. And then the lines are widely spaced. And where these curves cross give you actual sensitivity estimates for fuzzing the discovery. Here's example results for the discovery for most of the machines. So this is the five sigma discovery reach on the vertical axis as a function of integrated luminosity. On the horizontal axis, the colors show you different machines. Here's FCC-HH in dark red. Here's HELHC in dark green. Here's LHC in dark blue. Our predictions are shown by the solid points. There's a previous work that was done, and that's shown by the dash points. Our projections increase linearly with the root S of the machine, and they increase logarithmically with the integrated luminosity, which is what we naively expect. And they're within 10% of the previous studies. And for FCCHH, we have at 30 inverse Attlebarns, we have a 44 TeV discovery of an excited quark. And for HELHC, we have a 13 TeV discovery. Example results on Q-star exclusions. Again, they're shown here. Now we compare also with CMS public expected limits. From the current value of 140 inverse femtobarns going all the way down, even beneath the plot I show here, to 10 and beneath inverse femtobarns. And the exclusions agree very, very nicely and scale in the same way as the CMS data is scaling. Of course, it's a very small lever arm compared to what we're showing. Here, there are more significant differences with previous FCC studies, but we agree with all the CMS data. And we have, of course, a larger exclusion of 50 TeV than we have a discovery, which was 44 TeV. So here are the results for all scenarios then. Preliminary Q-star discovery exclusion masses versus integrated luminosity for all PP collision energies from the LHC in blue to the collider in the C in magenta. So that's the status at the moment. So we're estimating sensitivities to multiple models and diejet resonances across a wide range of PP collision energies and integrated luminosities. A simple methodology gives robust predictions. It reproduces CMS run two backgrounds and LHC expected limits for all models. The shape of the diejet resonances at a fixed fraction of root S is approximately invariant when searches are conducted using Y jets that correspond well to partons. The sensitivity of cytochorics at PP collider scales as expected. It increases linearly with root S and logarithmically with the integrated luminosity. And here are some discovery values at HLHC of 7 TeV, HCLHC of 13 TeV, FCHH of 44 TeV. And I can mention that our current limit is around 6.3 or 6.4 TeV. So we have the possibility of discovery in the future for this particular model, though we're not necessarily interested in any one particular model. And future plans include other benchmark models, diquarks, colorons, W prime, Z prime, Rs, gravitons, and more signal shape studies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert. I think this was really nice. I particularly like the fact that you've actually already looked at different FCCHH center of mass energies, because that was one of our requests for snow mass. Would have been nice to sort of show that.
Thank you. Okay.
I see there is a hand raised already. Jim, please go ahead.
Robert, thanks for the super clear summary. That was really nice. Could you, I haven't been following closely, but I'm just curious, what are the plans for, will you use these results also for dark matter mediators, or will you basically hand off, can these be simply reinterpreted by someone in EF10 or?
They could be reinterpreted by people in EF10. It actually is true that the Z prime SSM is not very far different overall in its cross section from a dark matter mediator model. It's probably, 10 or 15%, 20% different, maybe max. And so we get the same basic sensitivity. But if somebody would provide me, or I could work with someone and get the actual cross sections in my actual mass windows, I could go ahead and produce dark matter mediator exclusions as well, if there is an interest to do that. I picked a range of models, but we could do it as well for the dark matter mediator. It's just going ahead and running off these cross sections at these root S's in these mass windows.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, I don't see EF10 conveners connected, but maybe you could touch base with them. Thanks.
There is a chat question. I don't know if the speaker wants to ask it, but I can read it if not. So Prudhvi, Beth, Tipralu, I'm sorry if I'm mangling your name, Prudhvi. I was wondering if the signal background interference is accounted for while setting / projecting limits. No, it is not accounted for. It is just the overall resonance shape, and we're not accounting for signal and background interference. So that will modify it slightly and change the overall acceptance of the signal into the mass window.
I see, thanks. I mean, especially for digluon resonances, these effects could be large.
Yeah, absolutely, digluon resonances. Well, I didn't actually cover digluon resonances here. They weren't one of the models I was actually looking at, but that is absolutely true. They are very complicated shapes, and the effects can be very dicey. So I didn't necessarily wanted to address them right away. So yeah,
thank you.
Some more work needs to be done in that area.
Yeah, thanks for that good point. Zen, please go ahead.
Yeah, very quick question, Robert. Thanks for a nice talk. So you, in the final part, you mentioned the future plan includes W prime and Z prime, et cetera. I'm wondering, do you still plan to only cover digits, or you are also doing dileptons and dipoles?
Just digits, only digits.
Oh, only digest. Okay, thanks.
I'll add models, but I'm not going to add different final states.
Okay, thanks.
I see that actually there's a question about how to raise hands. So if you go under reactions, you can raise your hand there, but it seems Ken Lane has a question. Ken, please go ahead.
Oh, wait, I have to unmute myself. There you go.
Hey, Ken.
Great. Hi, Bob. My question is, have you looked at what sort of limits you can put on a substructure scale, the old lambda of the good old days? Because it seems to me that those limits would be even higher.
You're absolutely right, Ken. The limits would be even higher on the scales than it is on the models like the Q-star, for example. And I haven't looked at that. That's much trickier. Those searches are much more dicey because they're looking at shape differences between the QCD and the contact interaction signal. They're much more difficult to actually conduct, and they're more prone to systematics. So you're right, they're very interesting, but I haven't done that.
But you would expect the limit would be rather higher without a lot of work than it would be, say, for a Q-star or a gluon star. Quark or gluon.
You will get a higher limit on the lambda scale, and you might be probing in the future physics even more. But there's always going to be an ambiguity on the tail, whether or not you're looking at the differences in the PDFs and the evaluation of the QCD background compared to a bump, which can't be mimicked by QCD. So that's the difference there, and so the interpretation is more difficult.
So now what I'm trying to say is not to go to the highest possible substructure scale you can go to, which I believe you that it's more difficult, but even finding a substructure scale that's above your limit, the limit you could reach for an excited quark scale, because you would expect to see expect to see the rise in the cross section due to the excited quark, which looks like a substructure scale, before you actually produce the quark.
Actually, that's possible as well. Yes. You could actually see that. Of course, the search would not care about that because it would just say, oh, that's a falling background. I'm looking for the bump on the falling background. I don't care if the falling background is modified by a contact interaction or not. And so the search would still work, but you're saying it would work, but we would notice the other thing first. And that may be relevant as well. Yes. I agree.
I think maybe it's a good point to, in the write-up, mention something to that effect.
Yeah.
But I think this is good discussion. We should move. We do need to unfortunately move on, but I invite you to carry on, offline as well. I actually also have a question, so I'll write to you about that, Robert. But sure. Thank you. And we should go on to our final talk for this session, which is a search for leptoquarks at future muon colliders. Please go ahead and share your slides. Get started.
All right, so can we see my slides?
Yes.
And if I move them, that's okay too?
No, they did not move for me. Could you try again, perhaps? It's not full screen, so maybe you want to go to full screen.
Okay. Yeah, let me try something else real quick. You know, like a year and a half of this, you'd think we'd have figured it out, but.
Yeah, it always happens when you need to do it, it doesn't.
All right, does it move if I do this?
Yes, now it moves, yep.
Okay, well, maybe we'll also sacrifice full screen then here today. But okay, well, thanks so much for having me. I'm Carrie Cicerotti. I'm a grad student at Harvard. And as mentioned, I'll be talking today about a recent publication of mine called Searching for Leptoquarks at Future Muon Colliders. This is done with my collaborators, Puyo Rodolfo and Sam. So certainly I don't need to convince this group that one of the biggest questions that we should be focusing on is how and where do we look for new physics? And certainly we've heard some really interesting talks today alone about where we can do this. And I want to mention other places that new physics searches are really feasible. Certainly at the LHC, there's enormous discovery potential, both in previously taken data and the future with the high LUMI. So we have some discussion of novel searches we can do there. We can also think about precision experiments, AMO measurements that are really, really precise measurements of these atomic transitions, such as the electron EDM measurements that can tell us about physics at very high energies. But really, if what we're looking for is to expand into the energy frontier and to be producing new physics on shell at about the 10 to EV scale, the most realistic option for us is to think about the construction of new colliders. So one possible option, we've heard some other options today, but another way that we can go is with the muon collider. And I think that this is a fantastic option because it's a complementary probe, both into learning about the standard model and beyond the standard model processes. So just as a comparison between a hadron machine and a muon machine, like I mentioned, one of the biggest advantages that we could get from this kind of machine is that we'd have much more energy available to us. So because we have to pay this price with the Parton distribution functions at the LHC, the center of mass energy is much less than the beam energy. Whereas for a muon collider, we have much more energy accessible. So here's a nice publication that I borrowed this diagram from. And we see that for beam energies of a hadron collider, in order to use the center of mass energy for both comparable and QCD enhanced amplitudes, we would need about a factor of 10 times the energy at a hadron machine. So this is really, a muon collider is a really promising way to expand our energy frontier. From a physics perspective, because the LHC again is colliding color charged objects, the kinds of new physics that we'll be studying is really going to be produced with color charged interactions. Whereas at a muon collider, we'll be focused more on the electroweak production of new physics or even standard model processes. So it's again, just a complementary insight that we would have. In the same vein, because these are colored objects, it would be a hadronized final state that would be what we're looking at, which can be a little bit messy. Whereas at a muon collider, we'd be having a much smaller QCD background, potentially a cleaner signature and definitely sensitive to different kinds of physics searches. So this might seem just generic to a lepton machine. So let me compare again to an E plus E minus machine. Going back to this picture of how do we build this and what energies can we do? At a muon collider, since muons are so much more massive than an electron, we would actually have less synchrotron radiation. So getting to these higher energies would be a little bit easier in terms of our engineering. And then again, from a physics perspective, at an EE machine, we'd be really sensitive to new physics that couples directly to the first generation. And this has been studied quite a bit. So if we want to think about how do we get the most bang for our buck for novel kinds of fit signatures that we can look at, a muon collider can directly probe the second generation couplings that might otherwise be suppressed. So really, it's a quite interesting thing to do. So to summarize why we should consider muon colliders, again, it would provide a very complementary and a robust physics program. And to illustrate this point, the focus of the rest of this talk is a particular new physics scenario that we could search for, and that is the search for vector leptoquarks. So leptoquarks is a pretty big category of new physics. Today, I'm going to be talking about one possible leptoquark that we could have. And so this is a spin one particle. In the literature, it's canonically called the U1 particle. And here is its representation under the standard model gauge group. So we see that it has, of course, both a color charge and a hypercharge. All right, so these kinds of particles are motivated both from a top-down and bottom-up approach. If we want to think about just generic UV completions that make sense in our universe, these kinds of leptoquarks emerge in Patti Salam spectrums that go along with grand unified theories. And this is a really nice publication by the Zurich group that sort of gives you all those messy details worked out quite well. If we want to think about it motivated, given the anomalies that we have currently, leptoquarks can actually address various flavor anomalies and don't get in the way or violate any other low energy color or flavor observables. Okay. And going back to this point about why it's complementary to hadron machines, a muon collider could explore a complementary parameter space to what we've been looking for at the LHC. So really, these are a great model that we could be searching for that could answer potentially some longstanding questions. So here is our minimal EFT that we consider in our paper. In this Lagrangian, we have first our kinetic term, and this is the covariant derivative, so coupling to gauge bosons too. There's a mass term, and then there's explicit couplings to these gauge fields as well. Then, of course, this last term is where we get the namesake, leptoquarks coupled to leptons and quarks directly. So this last term is going to be of particular interest for the rest of this discussion, because this is the thing that can be, that couples the leptoquarks such that we can produce it directly in our mu-mu collisions. So naively, there's quite a few parameters here, so we need to make a couple smart choices to make this a tractable model to actually search for robustly. First of all, we only consider left-handed couplings, as you see in this Lagrangian here. We do that because we can actually get all of the desired phenomenology regarding these flavor anomalies just from considering the left-handed things. But if we were to consider a right-handed field, a lot of our bounds are actually transferable. We just need to rescale the coupling to make sense with that model. In this particular Lagrangian, we're assuming that the U1 or the leptoquark is fundamental. And that would just change basically the couplings that couple directly to these gauge bosons is how that would rescale. So we consider it in depth in our paper and we find that the overall behavior isn't significantly affected by considering it to be composite versus fundamental. And then finally, again, these beta matrices have quite a few entries to it. So we consider some additional structure onsets just to make this problem tractable. So like I said, our right-handed terms, we'll set these to zero. And for our left-handed couplings, we consider the following structure. So this row and column here that are zeros, these are the first generation couplings. And previous experiments have already done a really excellent job constraining these couplings. So we're just going to set them to zero and not focus on them for the rest of this discussion. The second column corresponds to direct couplings with the muons. So these are things that can be directly produced. And so beta 2-2 is mu and strange quark, and beta 3-2 is mu and bottom quark. Right? And then these other two couplings can show up via internal lines or can change what sort of final state decays we expect of our leptoquark. So to summarize, here are the free parameters of the model that we explore. We focus really on this entry, this beta L3-2, which is again muon and B quark coupling to the leptoquark. And we do that for two reasons. One, because we want to consider some coupling that can be directly produced from our muon beam. And we consider the bottom quark especially because we want to consider experimentally tractable signatures. And if we have the option of B tagging, it might be a little bit easier to actually tease this signal out. So beyond that, we consider four different scenarios that kind of motivate how we look at these other couplings. Scenario one, we turn off all the other couplings, just this one. Scenario two, we set the coupling to strange in mu to be the same as to bottom in mu. Scenario three, we leave the strange mu coupling off and then choose fixed values for the other two couplings with the tau. And for scenario four, we turn them all on. And then we consider a range of these different values for this beta L3-2 coupling. The masses that we're sensitive to given this choice of couplings is going to be between 1 and about 50 TeV, which is beyond what we can do at the LHC right now. So again, complementary program. And then we make this choice to consider a 3 and 14 TeV muon beam, which is reasonable, feasible, and certainly talked about. So again, the different scenarios will really just change most effectively the final states of our leptoquark decays. So here is a quick summary of what different flavor observables we would see if we were to have this model, and what relevant couplings would need to be on in order to get some contribution from the leptoquarks. There's quite a few, but I really want to highlight one of particular interest, especially as of late, and that's the RK anomaly. There can be a tree-level contribution from this leptoquark, as shown here. And if we match the EFT and do some fits, we find that this is going to be the bound on our couplings and our mass. So this number will show up later. I just wanted to make clear that this diagram is where this bound is effectively coming from. All right, so there are three main production modes that we would consider, and they basically just correspond to how many on-shell leptoquarks we would be considering for these first two, the pair and the single, and then the Drellian, everybody knows and loves. So the single production actually doesn't set any leading bounds. So I'm not going to talk about that today in the interest of time, but it is there and we consider it. All right, so let me discuss how we do these other two scenarios, and we simulate all of our information using MADGRAPH5 and the LeptoQuark package by the Zurich group. So in our pair production here, effectively we're considering two on-shell or near on-shell LeptoQuarks in our final state. And then depending on the scenario, that dictates if we're getting either B mu or B tau final states for our decay. What I want to highlight here is that only one of these diagrams actually has direct couplings with the muon. Everything else just has the couplings with the electroweak gauge bosons. So we'll find that as we eventually reduce the coupling to the muon sufficiently, we'll find that basically we become independent of that coupling and it's just about the gauge boson couplings. All right, and then we'll also of course have some backgrounds. Here's some diagrams that correspond to that. So we are theorists, so excuse us for our naivete, but we try to do some help for the experimentalists and figure out how we can reduce the standard model background. And we find that for this pair production, an excellent way to reduce nearly all of the standard model background is to impose a cut on the BB invariant mass. So because the standard model, again, here's our backgrounds, we expect that these should be falling like a rock in terms of the standard model invariant B mass. So for our LeptoQuarks, things quite a bit. If we impose just a modest cut of a few TeV, depending on what center of mass energy we use, we find that we can basically reduce the standard model background to zero just by this one cut. Right. The other production mechanism that's most important is our Joule-Yann backgrounds. We see that for the LeptoQuark production, we have the T channel, whereas for the standard model, we have an S channel. And this is good news because clearly these are going to be most prevalent in different regimes of kinematic space. So our standard model background is going to be falling like a rock as we increase our energy. In order to calculate our log likelihood for this and to figure out our reach, we make the additional step of binning our B quarks in eta and then computing our log likelihood from there. So you see for future analyses, depending on the mass of the LeptoQuark, we might actually be able to like further mitigate our signal from our background by imposing an eta cut. But since we do get some overlap for different values of the mass of our LeptoQuark, and at this stage we want to remain as agnostic as possible, we ourselves do not impose an eta cut, but just something to keep in mind for potential future analyses. Right, so here is our money plots. Here is our discovery potential at a muon collider. First, I'm gonna show you the 3 TeV muon beam. And here are different production mechanisms. So this line here is our pair production. This small area up here is our single production, and then Joule-Yann kind of sweeps across. So here's our different flavor scenarios summarized for you at the bottom of the screen. And we see that for 2 and 4, the RK anomaly could be present or explained by the LeptoQuarks. So anything to the right of this blue band would be consistent with our RK anomaly. And we see that there's this nice parameter space that we can reach. So it's really exciting that even at this kind of lower energy muon colliders, we would still be able to probe in a really interesting regime where we might be able to resolve some longstanding anomalies. Okay, and then something else I want to point out, you see this straight line feature in the pair production. That's again when we go into this regime where the coupling is so small that the direct production from the like the LeptoQuark produced by interacting directly with the muon beam is less, contributes less to the overall cross-section than the gauge boson coupling. So then it just becomes independent of this variable. All right, and then the same is shown here, but now for 14 TeV center of mass energy, and we see roughly the same behavior everywhere. Again, here's our RK anomaly bounds, and everything to the right would be fair game that we could search for. All right. There we go, okay. So to summarize, a future muon collider is a really excellent physics prospect because we can probe complementary parameter space to the LHC and to other existing experiments. LeptoQuarks are particularly well-motivated models to consider because they have both bottom-up and top-down motivations. And what's exciting when we combine these two ideas is that the parameter space of these LeptoQuark models that resolve current anomalies will be within the reach. So thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Carrie. This was a really nice study and actually very interesting to see that even with the low energy muon collider, you can start to do very interesting physics in this area. Okay, I already see a hand up. Matt, please go ahead with your question.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for this talk. I think it was super interesting. I had a couple of questions, which I think should be super easy, but I was just wondering about a couple of things on your plots.
Please.
On slide 12, I think, Could you explain maybe why the background increases at high MBB in the bottom plot? No, the plot before this, sorry, or the slide before this.
Is this what you're talking about, Matt?
The on the right side, so the gray histogram starts to increase again.
Yeah, so this is something that's a little bit complicated. So I mean, I'll show you these diagrams that get a little bit messy. There's actually more diagrams when we don't need to have these taus in the final state. So I think what's happening is that there's going to be some interference that starts happening or some more suppression because of internal lines when we consider just this mu mu state, but then there's something that happens in the taus in specific that doesn't quite kill off this tail all the way out here of essentially just producing two really hard things with the same initial energy as the beam. But we can mitigate this. I think we found that it was really easy to get rid of this bump if we just did some cut on like the angle in which these things were coming out, because they'd have to be super boosted objects.
Okay. Interesting. So that's sort of related to my next question, which was you were mentioning the eta cuts, I guess on the next two slides from now, where you're trying to separate the S and T channel production. So mm-hmm. did you just look at binning this in eta, or did you look at other things like the rapidity star, things that are used in digest resonance searches, basically?
Yeah, so good question. We considered a couple of different kinematic variables, but because this is just a back-to-back thing, a lot of the things that we would consider are just correlated, like PT, cosine, eta, rapidity, things like that. So did we do fancy jet level analysis? No, we did not. We are but humble theorists. But that could potentially be a good way to further reduce the background, because this is by far the channel that has the biggest standard model background, especially if you want to look at slightly lower order TeV masses for leptoquark. So that's an interesting feature study to consider.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Jim, you have a question?
Yes. Thank you for the very clear talk. This analysis is so thorough. It's really great to see. I have actually a request for you to consider.
Oh, please.
Would you be interested? So I completely understand the motivation for the muon collider, and I'm really happy to see that as your main focus. It would be great if you were able to benchmark it against a couple other collider scenarios, maybe not in quite as much depth if that becomes practically or logistically very difficult, but if you picked a few of your models to benchmark against high energy proton-proton collider, or even, even E plus E minus, but proton-proton certainly. That would be, I think, really nice for the paper to see an apples to apples, the eventual report to see an apples to apples comparison, which be with all the same assumptions.
Okay, yeah, so, fantastic. That would definitely be really valuable for the final snow mass, right?
Yeah, thank you for considering. Thanks. We'll be in touch with about that.
And I think that's an excellent question, Jim. This is going to be mine too. So I think it'll be really comprehensive if you could have different colliders there, then we can really say something concretely.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks.
Simone, you have a question?
This is a very nice talk. Thank you very much for really this presentation. I was wondering a couple of things. So I assume that in these plots, you essentially use sort of the muon collider that we scared. I was mostly wondering about the assumption on sort of B-jets.
Are you wondering about our assumption about how we would be able to actually tag these B-jets?
Yeah.
Yeah. So our assumption was basically that since we're working in a muon environment, it'll be much cleaner and there's not a lot of other hadronic activity going on mm-hmm. in the final state, so that our efficiency. So we imposed an acceptance of below about 8 of 2.4. So something that ended up being very similar to what we would do at the LHC anyways, just to make sure we're not getting all that high energy stuff. But apart from that, I am sorry to say that I think we assumed a near 100% acceptance.
Okay, so you basically only retain from your background things that have a true B.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, it is perfectly fine and understandable. I think it just, obviously, I mean, a presentation, you're limited in time. It would be really good to just make sure that it's spelled out very clearly.
We would love experimentalists to actually give us reasonable feedback about what is the more feasible backgrounds that we would need to consider.
Do you have a PT spectrum for these jets in one of these examples?
I have a PT spectrum? I don't know if I have. I probably don't have that.
Okay, or what's the minimum PT you're considering for these jets?
So
I'm just trying to gauge a little bit the sort of how far this of course the lowest. Yeah.
We're definitely considering like reasonable jets, like things that are above like 20 GeV or things like that are the PT. And these things are really hard objects, right? Because they're just coming from this very high energy beam. So especially for the Drillian, we'd be considering like very like hundreds of GeV PT jets, I think is a pretty safe assumption.
Yeah. Okay, exactly. I mean, I'm just saying that maybe, that's another type of sort of additional plot, which maybe doesn't add much on the theory point of view, but on the experimental side, it helps a lot in understanding how solid these type of assumptions can be. And, you know, if you show that most of the jets are sort of 100 GeV and above, they're very easy to reconstruct, even on a muon collider environment and so on and so forth. If they're mostly, you know, exponentially falling, particularly at 20, 15 GeV, that becomes harder.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thanks.
It's hard. I definitely, you know, when we talk about these future colliders, you want to do a thorough job, but at the same time, we just don't necessarily know the experimental challenges of these things yet. So
yeah, and
I guess it's going to be a lot of back and forth for the next 50
absolutely.
Years,
right? And let me take the occasion to say, you know, if you have any doubts about any of these assumptions, you're not sure, etc., I mean, we are here for this. Write us an email and we'll be more than happy to sort of make sure to find the right people to put you in contact with and so on.
Fantastic.
Okay, so just for everyone, don't be shy in writing to us.
Yeah, and the hope of this NOMAS process is that it can actually bring people doing phenomenology and theory and experimentalists together and to, you know, just have a better result at the end. So yeah, please do take advantage. I see a question in the chat. Prithvi, do you want to ask it yourself or should we read it out?
Yeah. So is Delphus used in the study? Sorry, I'm not very familiar with this, the muon collider study.
We didn't need to use Delphus, but we use MadGraph-5 and then to get some of our, to do these things where we needed the gauge bosons. We use like the effective photon or the EPA package in MadGraph to make sure that we were getting these radiation distribution energies correct. So we didn't use Delphi's for this study.
I see. So is there any other detector simulator that you have used? Or
we did not consider any detector simulation. No.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
So again, very, very high level, best case scenario.
Got it. Thank you.
But this is, you know, it's potentially very interesting. So there are experimentalists out there attending today's meeting who are interested in pursuing this. Please definitely contact Carrie.
Please.
And maybe we can have a, you know, experimentalist side of things as well. But this is very promising, especially seeing the results from the low energy muon collider as well, given all of the discussions we're happening. So I think at this point, I think we're a little bit over on our, and I'm sorry for eating into the lunch break, but I think we had some very, very nice talks by Carrie, Robert, and Julia. So again, thank you very much to all of the speakers and to everybody who attended for the very good discussion. So please do come back in about 45 minutes. We'll have the continuation of the EFO8, EFO9 parallel session, starting with a couple of talks and then dedicated discussion on topics en route to the SNOMAS report. So thank you all and see you in a bit. Bye-bye.
Bye, thank you. Thank you. Hello,
Meenakshi. Hi, Alessandro. So I have this weird situation where I'm in. I can't really go from my from the breakout room. If I move out, I don't know how to get back to my to the main room from the breakout room as the host on my iPad, which is where I am.
That's strange, because from a computer, there are three options. So leave the room, leave the meeting for all.
Yeah.
Or leave the breakout room.
I know, but from my iPad, I only get an option end as a host.
Ah, that's dangerous. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't really know what to do. Given that very few people connected, I think we'll just have to, if I end this, then.
So, but.
Or can you move me? Can you move me to the main room?
I don't have, as MN or which one? MN.
Yeah. I'm in.
I don't have rights, actually. As co-host, I cannot move you. I have to be host. Can you make me host?
I can't. I cannot. I just cannot do anything. Since maybe if you come to my same breakout room, I can make you host, probably.
Oh.
This is Laura. It's
bizarre. We are in the main room, right?
Right. And all three of us are listed as co-host.
That's bizarre. But as the host, I'm in the other breakout room.
Okay. I'll join you in EF8, EF9, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, yeah.
Okay. Hello, Meenakshi, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. So.
And you're host, yes.
I can make you a host. Let's see whether I could do that. How does one do
it's interesting. You connected as MN, so it looks like you're connected as with the same account twice. Is it
is
right?
That, so is it confused about me? Okay, I'll have to just. I'm gonna go. I can't make you a co-host or anything yet, or a host. It says mute us to start video chat rename. That's all the options I get for you. So,
I think it's because are you connected with your CERN account or your Brown account in this one?
No, I'm connected with my CERN account.
Okay, that should be why it doesn't work.
That is why I have an issue there. So I'm going to just get out and people will just, let's see what happens.
Try out and see what happens.
Okay, let's see what I'm going to just, if I say.
Yeah, I'll stay in this room and I stop recording, by the way.